About this time, 5th Fighter Command sent us a P-47 simply to play with, as it were. They sent it up with instructions that everybody was to get checked out in this airplane, and I got my turn and flew it for an hour. And whereas I started out being terribly prejudiced against this airplane after I'd flown it, it was like driving a Cadillac after a Model T Ford, it seemed to me. Very quiet and powerful, and beautifully easy on the controls, in a cockpit big enough for two, practically. It was a very surprising and very pleasant experience. I remember that. And, of course, I was pleased at having had a chance to fly something different for a change, even though I flew it only for an hour. I'd had a long time argument with Jack Farrell. I maintained that I could do a loop off of the ground, so to speak, and he said that was quite impossible. Well, I knew better. And one day I had to go down to Port Moresby to bring back a new airplane, and when I got back to Goosap, I dove on the field right down, flew down the runway as low as I could get, and did a loop. And since, of course, I had plenty of room left at the last part of the loop, I just, on purpose, let the airplane get as low to the ground as I dared again, and flew down the strip and pulled up and came around and landed. And old Duncan Myers was there. Well, he said, "I saw you go up. I saw the thing go up and up, and I wondered what the hell was going on." And I went outside, and there it was. You were at the top of this loop. And I said, "Well, we've lost another plane and pilot." And I said, "Well, that's all nonsense." I said, I told Farrell I could do a loop off the ground. He said I couldn't, and now you've got witnesses that it can be done. And it's a very simple matter furthermore. So I made my point. We had a new pilot assigned to us, and he was put in our tent with Eigelhart and me and whoever else was in the tent. And he wanted to fix the tent up, and for that we needed a lot of poles, which meant going out into the woods and getting them. Well, we didn't want to go on our side of the valley because that was a known hazardous area, so we got a jeep and drove over to the north side of the valley to the woods over there and cut down a bunch of small trees that we could make poles out of. We spent all day at it, and it was a hard, sweaty, hot job, and I worked with my shirt off, which was probably a mistake. And when we got back from that little trip, at the end of the day, I learned, to my surprise rather, that I had been promoted to captain. But I think at the same time I had also picked up some mosquito bites or something, because only a few days later I came down with a bad case of dengue fever. That's D-E-N-G-U-E. It's much like malaria, except there doesn't seem to be any protection against it, and it's very painful. You ache terribly from head to toe for days and run extremely high fevers and hallucinate, and it's all quite unpleasant. They sent me down to Dobradira to the hospital, where seems to me I was not treated very well. Initially, there were five or six of us, the others being strangers, but sick people. And we were taken out to the hospital, and nobody did a thing for us, just let us sit around outside in the hot sun. Finally, we all just lay down on the ground and tried to sleep or something. And eventually, they admitted us and put us to bed, but I thought it was no way to treat sick people. Anyway, after about a week in the hospital, I was entirely recovered and went back to the squadron. and learn that I and others including Jack Farrell and Bobby Harrison probably, Joe O'Connor I know, and some other people were all being sent to Sydney on leave. And I, for one, needed it. And the second place, it was pleasing because Jack and I had always wanted to go on leave together, and this is the first chance we had ever had to do that. So we were flown down to Moresby and then down to Brisbane, where we spent the night, as we always did. Nearly froze to death, I remember that night. God, it was so cold. Neither one of us slept a wink. We were so cold, even in bed with blankets, we were cold. And the next day flew down to Sydney. I told you a long time ago that we had left all our good uniforms back in the States, and it had become necessary long before this to get new uniforms in Australia. They were made over there, and they weren't as nice as the U.S. ones, but they served the purpose. We were put up in some little hotel or other run by the Red Cross, I believe, and Jack and Joe O'Connor and I all had a room together. There was a double bunk, double-decker bunk that Joe and I had, and then there was a bed that Jack, you know, Jack got the bed somehow. And the first day we were there, we had gotten our... We never took our good clothes up to New Guinea because they'd just rot up there. We left them in a... There was a locker place. You could leave uniforms and possessions down in Sydney, and when you'd come down there, you'd get them, and that's what we did. We got our good uniforms and took them back to the hotel. Well, we went to various parties and did this and that and while we were in Sydney, and I remember one night some people in the squadron had rooms over in some place or other, in another part of town altogether, and they invited Jack and me over there one night to drink, and we did, and drank wine, I remember, and got terribly drunk. I did. Well, I had way too much to drink, I know that. Time we got back to our own hotel, we were tired and sleepy and went straight to bed, and a few days later we found ourselves back up at Port Moresby, where we had to spend the night. And it was a hot night, and we were at 5th Fighter Command. 5th Fighter Command was located in some sparse trees way up on the top of a hill, absolutely on the top. This hill just sloped off sharply in every direction practically, but there was a ridge along the top of it sort of, and room enough for buildings, and there were buildings, if you want to call these thatch hut sort of things buildings. And the big tent that transient officers were put in for the night was nothing but that, a tent farther down the hillside. And we went to bed. Joe Connor was with us and all, and we had no sooner gotten into bed than Jack said he was going to go for a walk. Did anybody want to go with him? And I said, yeah, I would go with him. And so we got up and put our clothes on, and it was like a full moon, or practically so, bright, warm, moonlight night. And we walked up to the top of the hill to Fighter Command headquarters, which, of course, were totally deserted at that hour. This must have been midnight or later. And the moon was bright and nice, and there were sort of benches and chairs set around outside the building, and we sat there and talked for a long time, and we eventually went down the hill and went back to bed. Next day we were supposed to return to Goosap, but Fighter Command wanted us to fly some new P-40Ns back up there instead of being taken back, and so Jack and I went over to 4 mile or one of those strips, I don't know, and where they had these P-40s, and we took two of them and flew back up there together. The two of us flew directly over nothing but absolute vast jungle and mountains the whole way. And sort of did it by guess and by God, I reckon. But we came out all right, right about where we were supposed to, and landed. That was most likely the last time that I flew in New Guinea as a pilot. Because a few days later, the orders came through for me to return home. When the day came, Jack Farrell was on alert. And so several of us, there were people that I knew well, was Paul Slocum and Johnny Miller and a guy from the 8th Squadron named Arthur Talmadge. Anyway, I took a Jeep and went down to the flight line, and Jack and I walked off by ourselves. He couldn't go very far away in case he had to go somewhere on a mission, but we went over amongst the airplanes and had a little farewell chat. And then we left. We caught the morning C-47, which was in every morning with supplies and things, and took it down to NADZAB and were transferred to a C-47. Flown by the Air Transport Command. We'd had very little, if any, experience with the Air Transport Command people, but they were not combat pilots. They were transport pilots, and they were good at it, good on instruments. And we flew from NADZAB to Port Moresby by way of Dobradira, though we didn't land in Dobradira. And several of us, I remember, got the notion we were going to piss on New Guinea all the way out. And we pissed on Ley, and we flew over Dobradira. We pissed on Dobradira, and we got near to Port Moresby. We pissed on Port Moresby. I remember that. But the memorable thing was that when we got to Port Moresby, the place was practically socked in. We'd been flying on instruments for half an hour or more. Well, none of us people knew how to fly instruments very well. But apparently they had put in some sort of instrument equipment on the ground there at Port Moresby, because these guys, to our consternation, I'm talking about the pilots, suddenly put down their landing gear. This was in a C-47, and flaps, and came in there, and the first thing we knew, we broke out of the clouds right over the end of the strip and landed nice as you could please, which filled us with amazement. None of us could have done a thing like that, and we didn't know there was anybody else around there that could do a thing like that. I expect we spent the night there, and the next day we took off on another C-47 for Brisbane and went down to, Amberley Field, where the Air Transport Command hung up. And we hung around there for a while, several days. And I remember on one occasion I had all this money in cash, and it was Australian money, and I got this idea that I would take it over to the finance officer on the base and exchange it for American money. Well, they didn't have any American money, but they said, here, we'll take this money and we'll give you a check for the exact amount in dollars and cents, and then when you get to California, you can cash the check, and there you'll be. And that's what they did, and it worked out beautifully, because I didn't have a cent of Australian money with me when I left Australia, and that was a considerable convenience. Well, the night came when we were to leave, and They came there. They had some customs people, U.S. customs people, and they came up there and went through all our belongings and asked if we had any diaries or anything of that sort. Well, I did. I had two volumes, and they took them away from me and signed for them, gave me a receipt. And several months after the war was over, these two diaries arrived in Harrisonburg in the mail, safe and sound. Anyway, we took off about midnight in a C-54. And I remember in the center portion, it was just a cargo type thing. There were bucket seats along the sides, up and down each side, and that's all. There were some mail sacks on the floor. But in the center section, over the wing, where there would have been further facilities of some kind, there were just two enormous cylindrical gas tanks, one on either side of the center aisle. We took off about midnight, and there must have been bad weather or something. They didn't want to fly through because they took off from the field and circled the field, climbing all the time, a big climbing circle for nearly half an hour, round and around, higher and higher and higher, and finally, couldn't have been a half an hour, seemed a long time anyway. Finally, they lit out over the ocean, and we lay down on the floor and went to sleep. And when we woke up, it was, 9 o'clock in the morning or something, and we were landing at Nandi, N-A-N-D-I, in the Fiji Islands. I got to read you my orders sending us home, and they say, under provisions of so-and-so and so-and-so, the following named officers are relieved from present assignment and further duty in the Southwest Pacific area. Will proceed to the United States, reporting upon arrival to air or water port of debarkation for further disposition. Travel by military, naval, or commercial aircraft, number 4 priority, army or naval transport, belligerent vessel or aircraft, commercial steamship, or any other means of travel to the United States is authorized. Personal baggage not to exceed 55 pounds authorized while traveling by air. So, we landed in the Fijis and the airplane had engine trouble of some kind, which they worked on for about 4 hours without any success. And by then it was early afternoon and the pilot and co-pilot of this airplane were ATC people and had formerly, before they got into the military, were flying airliners for United Airlines. Well, about that time, another C-54 came in, and it had nobody on it at all to speak of, and so we were transferred to that airplane, because the engine had not been fixed on the other one, and we took off. Flew all afternoon and all night and landed in the middle of the night, 2 a.m. or some ungodly hour like that, at a little atoll in the mid-Pacific called Canton Island. There was nothing much there, and I remember we got out and walked around a little and drank a cup of coffee or something, and even at 2 a.m. it was hotter than blazes on this place. Boy, was it hot. Anyway, the airplane was having some brake trouble, but they seemed to fix it enough, and we took off after refueling and flew all the rest of the night and much of the next day. Of course, there were time changes, and I don't know what, except that we finally arrived at Hickam Field in Honolulu in the late afternoon. And apparently they had some sort of recognition procedure necessary there, because this plane flew along the coast of Hawaii, past Honolulu, on up the coast, for about 5 minutes, and then made a big U-turn to the left, came back down the coast, and into Hickam Field and landed. Well, they said they were having brake trouble, and we had time to wander around a little, so we went into the officer's mess and ate dinner. And it still wasn't dark, and when we got back to the airplane, they were still messing with the brakes, and they kept that up for quite a while. We were in Hickam Field about 4 hours, I believe. Anyway, soon after dark, they took off again for San Francisco. And we flew all night and landed at Hamilton Field, which is up north of San Francisco in Marin County. And it was raining when we landed, and they still had trouble with the brakes. In fact, so much trouble with the brakes, they couldn't taxi in, and somebody had to come out with a tow truck and tow the airplane into the hangar or flight line or whatever. At Hamilton Field, they put us through a bunch of, I don't know what. We had a physical exam, I know, and we had a bath and a shave and all that, and filled out innumerable forms and were treated like kings or something. And finally were put on a small bus and driven down to San Francisco. And in the meantime, I guess from Hamilton Field, I had called Fred Doyle, and he told me to come down to the PG&E building down at Lower Market Street. And he would wait for me there, and it didn't matter when I got there, just to come. So I did that, and I got into the city. They let us out, and I took a taxi. I don't know where I got money, American money, but I had it. And I took a taxi down, and Fred Doyle was waiting for me, along with some of his colleagues. Anyway, he drove me back to the house, and where his wife was, and they treated me royally, and had a big dinner, and it was all quite splendid. And I remember he phoned mother and father, or mother anyway, back in Harrisonburg. Now, that was a big deal in those days. Nowadays, we phone across the country and don't think anything about it, but it wasn't that simple a matter then. But he did it, and I talked to mother and home. And I stayed in San Francisco probably all of the next day. I don't think longer than that. And then we had managed, Paul Slocum and I, to get airplane tickets, which were very hard to come by. But they gave them to us at Hamilton Field. From San Francisco to Los Angeles to, for me, Chicago. I was going to spend some time with Tom and Betty. And the Doyles took me out to dinner that night, I remember, and we stayed too long so that we were perilously close to being in danger of missing my flight. And we started to drive to the airport, and Mrs. Doyle said, "Let me drive, because I drive better than you do," to her husband, and he remonstrated, but I noticed he let her drive, and they got me down there to SFO, which in those days was called Mills Field. And we didn't miss the flight. Paul Slocum was there. And maybe John Miller, I don't remember, but I know Paul Slocum was. And we got on this DC-3 and were flown down to L.A. and spent hours down there and finally got another flight out. Flew to places like Phoenix and Oklahoma City, and then I think from Oklahoma City directly up to Chicago. But of course, with the DC-3, these flights went on and on and on and on for many, many hours, and they were cold. The plane wasn't very well heated, and it was snow on the ground and bitter cold outside, but I don't think any of us gave a damn. And somehow, perhaps from Oklahoma City, I don't know, I had gotten in touch with Tom and told him when I was scheduled to arrive at Chicago. And most flights didn't make it to Chicago. The weather was very bad, but ours did. The guy, this was a United Airlines flight, and they flew not very far off the ground, under a solid overcast, and came in there and landed hours and hours late. God knows how many hours late it was. But there was Tom waiting for me, and Paul Slocum stayed at the airport. He was going to go on to Ithaca, New York, or wherever it was he lived. And Tom drove me on into Hinsdale. And, of course, he had two children, Lynn and Kathy, that neither one of which I had ever seen before, I think. Well, that can't be true. I hadn't seen Kathy. Certainly I'd seen Lynn, though she was a year and a half or more older by that time. But I'd never seen Kathy before. I stayed there several days, and I remember the first day we went out, Tom went to work, but Betty and I went downtown for something, and I drove, and we got downtown. I don't mean downtown Chicago. I mean downtown Hinsdale. And Betty said, "Harry," she said, "you're driving on the wrong side of the street," which, of course, I was, because I'd been used to doing nothing else but that for the last year or more, and that's what came naturally. Well, eventually I got a flight to Washington, and Mother was going to meet me in Washington, but again, things were against us, and the weather was bad, and the flight couldn't land at Washington, was diverted, and landed in New York City instead. LaGuardia, I suppose. And I went into town and got a train to Washington, and got a bus. Of course, Mother had gone back to Harrisonburg by that time. And then I got a bus from Washington down to Harrisonburg and got there in the middle of the night. And so I thought, rather than wake people up and all that stuff, I would just stay in a hotel in Harrisonburg, which I had never done before in my life, of course, the Cavanaugh Hotel. I got a room there and spent the night there, and in the morning I got up and shaved and showered and dressed and got a cab and went up to 291 Franklin Street, where Dick and Fred were still asleep. Anna was there, and Mother and Anna were getting breakfast. And I just walked in the door and never felt so glad to be home in my life. I suppose I had not been there since the 7th of November, 1941. And it was now sometime in February 1944, for heaven's sake. So there I was, home again. This tape is about to run out.